Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, September 16th, 2016. That's 9/16/16. And if you're, you know, fascinated by numbers, this is my 1,800th podcast. Yes, number 1,800 since I started in June of 2009. If you've been along for the whole ride, wow. Thank you very much. And we're now available on YouTube. Our YouTube channel is getting populated. People are subscribing. It's just another way you can capture the Peter B. Collins podcast. Hope it's convenient for some people who may find iTunes or other systems cumbersome. And you can always come directly to peterbcollins.com. That's where the mothership is of all of our podcast activity. Well, we have been covering the scandal at Wells Fargo Bank, where 5,300 low-level people were fired, and a senior officer was permitted to retire with a $125 million parachute after it was discovered that the bank is predatory in some respects because of heavy pressure on bankers to deliver more customers and more accounts to meet sales quotas. They were fudging. They were creating fake accounts and issuing fake bank accounts. And Public Citizen is taking up the charge to break up Wells Fargo. Bart Naylor over at Public Citizen has raised the flag and called for a breakup of Wells Fargo Bank. Bart, thanks for joining me today. This is on the heels of the firing of 5,300 low-level employees who violated policy by opening fake accounts and credit cards for customers in order to meet sales quotas. And there's a lot of outrage that the CEO, John Stumpf, is still there and claims that it was, you know, not company policy that led to this fraudulent activity. You don't seem to agree with Mr. Stumpf.
In one sense, I do agree that Mr. Stumpf seems to be declaring that while they have policies and rules, they are unable to keep a few bad apples, 5,300 of them to be more precise, from violating them. I would call that unmanageable. Why is it unmanageable? It's too big. That 5,300 is part of roughly 260,000 employees of Wells Fargo. And it's inevitable that there'll be some problems, there'll be some wayward employees. It's just that in the law of large numbers, you take 0.5% and you're right there at 5,000 people. So I think the bank is too big. We know, all Americans know, that they're too big to fail. We've had to bail them out. We know that they're too big to jail because we've had massive criminal activity identified by the Department of Justice, and yet no individual has been indicted, and no bank has had its charter taken away. And now Wells Fargo gives us a very important and vivid object lesson that it's too big to manage.
Now, I take your point, and you are going to champion a shareholder resolution at the upcoming, the next Wells Fargo shareholders meeting. Now, I happen to have a couple of shares of Wells, and I'm also a customer there. And one of the things I'll tell you is whenever you go in and talk to a banker, they are always compulsively upselling you. And I recently talked to a woman who left working at Wells because of the pressure that she felt every day to try to force products. They were told that each customer should have 8 Wells Fargo products and that they're supposed to keep pushing until they reach that goal. So we not only have a failure to manage a huge organization, and I take your point that it is too big to manage, but we also have the same policies that Fed Countrywide and the other mortgage companies that were writing loans and giving commissions and bonuses to people for steering customers into the worst loans that then went belly up. So aren't we seeing a repeat of that mentality inside Wells Fargo Bank?
Yes, we are. When Wells Fargo has always been famous for cross-selling. When it acquired Wachovia in a fire sale, it was somewhat controversial for shareholders, for example, because they wanted to know, well, can you keep that same cross-selling vibrancy going? And I think it was roughly then that aggressive entrepreneurship veered into meeting quotas at any way, and it verged into what is, in a sense, fraud.
Mm-hmm. And so firing John Stumpf, you don't think would fix the problem, even though it might be satisfying for people to see his head roll?
I think it may be necessary because he is part of the empire-building conceit. And it may be necessary to have a new CEO so that they can see what would be a good dynamic. Really, if you're an investor and you think about banks, the best growth opportunities for stock is not Wells Fargo or Bank of America. Those stocks have been going sideways, in Citi and B of A's case, very much down. It's a regional. It's a much smaller bank, a more nimble bank, a more manageable bank, a bank that actually knows its customers. These people don't really know their customers. They just know they got quotas to meet.
And Bart, when is the next Wells Fargo shareholders meeting?
They haven't, and they don't have to identify the actual date. It typically will be this spring. The deadline for filing shareholder resolutions is November. We filed ours yesterday, after which they will no doubt contest this with the Securities and Exchange Commission. That battle will have to finish by about mid-February, after which they print their proxy. That's the long ballot, mm-hmm. and the explanation for the ballot, after which is the shareholder meeting itself.
Well, as a shareholder, I'll look for that proxy, and I'll certainly vote it in support of your resolution. I only have a few shares, so don't expect a huge impact, but I have a massive listening audience coast to coast, and if you happen to be a Wells Fargo shareholder, don't sell yet. Hold on to your shares. When you get the proxy, you can vote in favor of the public citizen measure, and we'll see where it goes. Bart Naylor, thanks for bringing this to our attention, and thanks for this shareholder activism. I love it.
Thank you, sir.
My thanks to Bart Naylor at Public Citizen. He certainly knows the banking industry inside out. Well, Donald Trump has finally dropped his, six-year campaign, the birther campaign. He made a statement in Washington today without elaborating. He was giving tours of the new hotel built with non-citizen exploited labor. And at the end of a press conference or a statement that he made, he just added this: President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now, we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Now, he really picked up the birther flag and flogged it for a long time. But now he has finally backed off. But he has generated a new controversy at the same time, because he and his campaign are saying, well, you know, this actually originated from the Clinton campaign back in 2008. And there is one memo that was written by one guy who said, you know, how can we take on this Obama guy? And apparently questions about his birth status were raised. But I don't believe it was ever used publicly by the Clinton campaign. And I want to applaud the New York Times in part, because the headline of this story reads, Trump drops false birther theory, but floats a new one. And in this article, the word falsely pops up several times. Instead, he claimed falsely that questions about Obama's citizenship were initially stirred by Hillary Clinton in 2008. The article goes on to say that yesterday, Jason Miller, a Trump spokesman, asserted, also falsely, that Trump had obtained Obama's birth certificate and that closed the issue and relieved a nation that was really stressing about that matter. And I applaud the Times for calling something false. They're still not willing to use the four-letter word liar. And I have to ask, will the New York Times call out statements by Hillary Clinton that are provably false and call them false? So far, I haven't seen that. But I'll keep an eye peeled for it. The federal judge who Donald Trump has called a Mexican, but he's an American citizen named Gonzalo Curiel, he has ruled against a request from the Trump legal team to further delay the fraud trial against Trump University. So the judge has ordered that it will begin on the 28th of November, with some jury proceedings starting on the 10th of November, and the Trump team had hoped to push that back until next year sometime. So we are going to see something about that, but not until after the November 8th election. Yesterday, I went to my mailbox, and here is a letter to Peter B. Collins from Donald J. Trump. And it says it's personal. All right. I haven't opened it yet. I saved that for you, friends. There is a postage-paid envelope to send in my contribution. Yeah, right. I'm going to send in the envelope and make them pay for it. But there won't be any money in there. So here's the letter. Dear fellow American, one thing Hillary Clinton fears above all else is that Republicans will unite and rally against her. Well, somebody ought to check the mailing lists over there at the Trump campaign, because I have never registered as a... I haven't registered as a Republican for at least 15 years. I'll put it that way. So it's a, it was one of these four-page kind of old-school political letters with just a lot of short... perky little lines. I promise you we're going to make America great again. Blah, blah, blah. And then, oh, there's a poll. There's a poll that I can include. Oh, I see. It's a volunteer, and then they want my credit card. No poll. They they don't care what I think. So, can I make it from here to the recycling bin? Ah, I did. I scored. New polling information is... pretty troubling. It shows that Trump has tightened up the race nationally to a dead heat. It's less than a point and a half separating the candidates, and that, of course, is within the margin of error. Then when we look at key battleground states, Trump is up by almost a point in Florida. He leads Clinton by a point in Ohio, and he is also about 5 points ahead in Iowa. Now, Clinton is faring better in some critical states, but this is showing some real vulnerabilities as the race tightens up. And a New York Times CBS News poll asking questions is honest. Which candidate is honest and trustworthy? 33% give that trait to Hillary Clinton. 63% disagree. 35%, so 2 percentage points... advantage to Trump on honest and trustworthy. That this guy lies so obviously all the time. Let's see. Which candidate could bring about real change in the way things are done in Washington? Hillary Clinton, 36%. Donald Trump, 48%. Then who would do a better job at the economy and jobs? That advantage Trump, 51-43. On terrorism and security, advantage Clinton, 49-45. On immigration, this is a surprise. Clinton is showing 51% and Trump 43%. I thought that wall would help him more in that case. And on foreign policy, it's a huge gap in favor of Clinton, 58-36%. Now, in view of these polls, the Clinton campaign is dispatching Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders to the battleground state of Ohio, which I pointed out Clinton is currently running behind in, and they're going to try to persuade voters to suck it up and vote for Hillary. But it shows that the other polls show that enthusiasm on the part of Democratic voters is about 20 points lower than Republican voters, and that is likely to affect turnout in November. Then you have those peeling off to vote for third-party candidates, and that, with a very tight race like this, could cost Hillary the election. And we hear these kinds of loving statements. Here's Tim Ryan, a Democratic congressman from Youngstown. The more people hear about Hillary and what she's proposing, the more inclined they'll say, maybe she's not my first pick, but she's got a plan that is going to help us. That really reflects the desperate nature of Democrats who are appealing to the fear of the other rather than promoting the benefits, the positives of their candidate. There is a new report that has surfaced, and I want to note where it came from. It's in The Observer. And The Observer is owned by Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law. Nevertheless, here's an article that I find credible. I've linked to it so you can evaluate it yourself. Headline reads, former Democratic congressional candidate says Hillary stole Nevada. The man in question is Dan Raleigh. He lost in the primary in the 4th district in Nevada earlier this year. But he had an insider view, and he claims that the primary was rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton. He attended a fundraising call before the Nevada caucuses. He met with the Nevada Democratic Party executive board members, who told me they were aware that they were busing in caucus members from California. And he focused on the voter file. And you can recall that there was a DNC scandal because a Bernie Sanders employee briefly had access to the voter files collected by the Clinton campaign. And these voter files are really essential to running the kind of electronic campaigns that have become more and more impressive and successful. And we have to credit Barack Obama and his team for a lot of that. So when we look at the details, we know that the DNC staff, the WikiLeaks emails, show us that they were trying to give advantage to Clinton everywhere they could. And in Nevada, they pulled a few stunts where the party chair, Roberta Lange, broke the rules, bent the rules, and used her gavel in a very imperious fashion. And we also know that the DNC helped promote the false story that Bernie Sanders supporters were so upset at the way the caucuses were manipulated that they started to throw chairs in Las Vegas. And we know that one chair was hoisted in the air and then it was lowered to the ground. But this was the lowest point that I've experienced in the broadcast career of one Rachel Maddow, because she picked up the DNC, the pro-Clinton message, and she depicted the chair throwing by pulling file footage from a World Wrestling Federation show where they intentionally threw chairs. It was part of the gig, part of the act. And she acknowledged that she didn't have pictures of anybody throwing a chair in Las Vegas, but that didn't stop her from not only falsifying that report, but using these phony pictures to try to depict what didn't happen. There's an interesting poll that is profiled in the Upshot column at the New York Times today, and it's kind of a trick poll where they asked a group of people what they know and what they think about the Clinton Foundation. And they ask questions about things that are factually accurate about the foundation. Then they asked questions about activities that the foundation doesn't actually do, but other similar charities do. And the final set of questions included for-profit activities that are not part of the foundation. So what kind of results did we get? Well, among people who thought they could answer a question about the foundation, what the foundation does, more than half think that one function is setting up speaking engagements for the Clintons. And that, may be true, but as far as we know, the public posture is, oh no, that's all done privately, that's not part of the foundation. And frankly, I believe that. 39% of registered voters think the Clinton Foundation manages the personal finances of the Clinton family. Well, I don't believe that is true. And also 40% think that the foundation gives money to Democratic candidates. And the New York Times reports, and I'll take them at their reporting, that neither of those things is true. Now, when you separate out independent voters, 60% believe that part of the foundation's work involves setting up speaking gigs for the Clintons. So this shows, I've been a sharp critic of the Clinton Foundation. I think it is an influence peddling operation of the most obscene type. Yet the defenders say I'm sexist for raising these questions. It's because there's a female candidate running and it's just not fair. But leave me out of it. Look at the perceptions that way too many people have about what they think is going on at the Clinton Foundation. Now, one of the charges that's been leveled by Donald Trump and others, because of the emails that show that Clinton Foundation donors got access to Hillary at the State Department, is the phrase pay to play. Well, because of a leak from Guccifer 2.0, we are learning about the list of donors to the Obama administration, to the DNC, and the jobs that they got from the Obama White House. And over the years, we become accustomed that you can buy an ambassadorship if you give enough money to a political candidate, and that candidate wins. But chair of the FCC? Julius Genachowski donated $3.4 million to the Democratic National Committee, and Obama made him chair of the FCC for the first term. Now, I knew about Genachowski. I did not know about the money that he gave or bundled in order to buy that job. And, you know, ambassador to Finland, UN educational ambassador. They sold that to Crystal Nix-Hines for $600,000. I find that sordid, but it's ordinary. But this one really astounds me. Carol Mason donated about the fine print here is hard to read. It is $850,000 to the DNC, and Obama appointed her as Assistant Attorney General. Now, I am very troubled by that. Now, as I look through this list, there's one thing that stands out as a bit of a red herring. It shows the number 16 donor who got a favor from the Clinton administration was Steve Westley. And he's a Silicon Valley millionaire or billionaire. I don't know how much money he's got. But he previously served as the elected state controller of California. He served one term. He tried to run for governor. He was unsuccessful. He seems to be nursing ideas of running again. But it lists here that Steve Westley was rewarded by being named CFO of California, Chief Financial Officer. And I take it that that's somebody who made this list but isn't familiar with how things work here in California. Meanwhile, Barack Obama is once again conspiring with Republicans to kill a bill. This one is JASTA, the Justice, I can't remember what the acronym is for, but this is the bill that's favored by 9/11 families, which would enable lawsuits against Saudi Arabia in an effort to prove that the Saudis played a role in 9/11. And the reason the lawsuit route is necessary is that Congress and the 9/11 Commission and nobody else is willing to really explore these issues. They just want to seal the myth about 9/11. So Obama has signaled that he will veto the bill, but now he's delaying the veto as he contacts Republicans and tries to get them to change their vote. The Senate voted on this way back in the spring, and then the House passed it on the Friday before 9/11, which seemed to surprise some of the people in the Senate. So Obama argues that the legislation could open the United States to a barrage of lawsuits from private citizens overseas. I frankly think that's bullshit. I think he's protecting the Saudis, and he's protecting the Bush administration, and I still can't figure out why he would do either of those. Well, the Saudis, maybe. Oh, it is so ugly. It really is. Hey, I got a couple of notes from David Swanson today. One is that he's just published a new book called War is Never Just. And he is a great advocate for peace and a man I deeply respect. He is also a lead organizer in the events coming up September 23rd to 25th. That's next weekend at American University in Washington, D.C. And you can find out more information. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast at worldbeyondwar.org. And a whole impressive list of speakers will be presented on this two-day event, culminating in the award given to John Kiriakou, the Sam Adams Award, and it will be presented by Craig Murray, the former British ambassador who was initially denied a visa to enter the United States. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who make all this possible with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Folks like Grant Gibson, Faith Peoples, Terry Paris, Jason Spitzer, they're all monthly subscribers. And I really appreciate their support. How about you? How about the moment here of the 1800th podcast? Will that move you to take out a new subscription? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu tab, and then the pull-down appears. You click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. And you can pick $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual can earn you a bonus book. I have not given away the bonus books by Andrew Basevich and by Brad Schreiber about the SLA and the Patty Hearst kidnapping. So speak up. They could be yours. All the action is at peterbcollins.com. Well, this week, the NRA won a big victory in Missouri. And Missouri is now, in my view, the most dangerous state in America because they overrode the legislature, Republican-controlled legislature, on Wednesday, overrode the veto of Democratic Governor Jay Nixon of a package of bills that essentially gut any kind of meaningful gun regulation in the state. The new law will let citizens carry concealed weapons in public without a state gun permit, a criminal background check, or any firearms training. Anybody. I guess I'm not even sure if there is an age limit. But it appears that anyone in Missouri will be able to pack a concealed weapon, and they may not even know how to use it. This is such a dangerous, dangerous step. And it's promoted by the gun lobby that's funded by the gun industry that benefits from the sale of more firearms, and they don't give a damn about how many people die in the process. Not only did they ram through the veto override on the gun bill, but they also overrode a veto of a photo ID law to allow some good old voter suppression in time for the November election. And there are now 10 states that have loosened gun laws to allow concealed carry. And maybe the folks in Missouri got to figure out if, like in Texas, you know, it's now legal to carry a gun on campus at UT, but you can't have an exposed dildo. So maybe in Missouri, people will start openly carry dildos to send that same message as in Texas. New details have emerged from Columbus, Ohio, and they tend to support the police version of events in the shooting death of Tyree King, the 13-year-old suspect. As we're learning more, it appears that he was with two male friends. They attempted and maybe succeeded in robbing a man of $10 by brandishing a Ruger pistol. The victim of the $10 heist called the police dispatcher, who sent cops, who spotted three males, ordered them to stop. There was an initial effort to run. And in an interview with the Columbus Dispatch, Tyree King's friend Demetrius Brown said that the young man wanted to rob someone for money. Brown, age 19, said he was with King at the time of the shooting and that the 13-year-old's BB gun looked like a real firearm. The third person in the group, identified only as Braxton, said, "The cop said to get down. We got down, but my friend got up and ran. And when he ran, the cop shot him." Now, I still remain skeptical of the police story until I can see some video evidence or some eyewitness testimony that corroborates the cops. I still raise questions about whether it was necessary to shoot him repeatedly and if they needed to shoot to kill. The event occurred in the early evening when it appears it would not have been dark. Tyree King was an African-American boy, and the police officer who killed him was white. Vice News has announced a new lawsuit, joining the Associated Press and USA Today, suing the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act to get more information about the tool that was used to hack that iPhone owned by one of the shooters in last December's San Bernardino attack. And I applaud this. We know James Comey, the FBI director, has teased that the agency spent over $1 million to buy the hacking tool or the service in order to open this phone. And from Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe, the NSA veterans, who I interviewed a few weeks ago, you can find that at peterbcollins.com, they speculate that the FBI had already hacked the phone. But they were looking to widen their legal authority to do that by making a big deal out of Farouk's iPhone and raising questions about what could possibly be on it. And we knew it was bullshit. It was his work phone. And the FBI screwed up, that, if you remember. They had access to the phone initially, but then they changed the password on it, and then they couldn't figure out how to get it open again. So it was a whole Keystone Cops episode, and I'm glad these news agencies are trying to force disclosure. I also want them to force disclosure of the claim by the FBI director that the woman, Malik, posted a claim of allegiance to the Islamic State on Facebook, either during or after the shooting spree at that Christmas party of county employees. And I remain highly skeptical of that claim. I want to see proof, but I doubt if we ever will. Members of the House Intelligence Committee proved that that name is an oxymoron. They proved themselves to be morons by unanimously signing on to a letter sent to Obama yesterday urging him not to pardon Edward Snowden. Their response to the new Oliver Stone movie is to say, oh, he wasn't a hero. And in a pure Star Chamber move, they issued a 36-page report, but it's classified. And so they released a 3-page executive summary that portrays Snowden as a serial exaggerator and fabricator who is not a whistleblower. And when I look at this, it really turns my stomach. Because these are people who have either been compromised by the surveillance community. And Russell Tice has told us that the NSA has routinely put wiretaps and other surveillance on elected officials. So is every member of the Intelligence Committee compromised by the leverage that the NSA and the law enforcement communities have on them? Or are they merely tools who buy into the spook arguments that they're keeping us safe by monitoring millions of innocent Americans and gumming up their intelligence process with way too much data on people who are never going to be a suspect? I mean, there's not only the constitutional issue, there's the practical concern. And they're also using lies to smear Ed Snowden. Ben Wisner at the ACLU noted that the report states as a fact without documentation claims that Snowden took as many as 1.5 million documents from the NSA. And as I'll show you next, The Intercept shows that so far only 1,200 Snowden documents have been used in any way in the media reports that have surfaced. Also, the claim that he did all this damage, the most damaging public disclosure of classified information in our nation's history, thundered the letter. Well, I don't think that's true. It's embarrassing. It's exposed how much they lie to and manipulate the American people. Next time you see a member of Congress who you know is on the Intelligence Committee, like, oh, Mike Thompson from here in California, let him know you want your goddamn Fourth Amendment rights back. Over at The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald is observing radio silence on the new Snowden film. Because of competition in Hollywood, he kind of got cut out of the Oliver Stone package. But Jenna McLaughlin has published a piece with a kind of review of the film and an index, a list of over 150 articles from 23 news organizations worldwide that have been based on the Snowden files. So I hope you get to see the film over this weekend. I highly recommend it. And then go do a document dive at The Intercept, and you can find out more about what Ed Snowden has actually disclosed. Got an email from Russ Tice, an NSA whistleblower. Peter, we in the intelligence community do not give an oath to divulge secret information. We sign an agreement giving us access to classified intelligence, and in that agreement it states that we're subject to statutory law prohibiting unauthorized disclosure. This is why we say we were signed into this or that program, or signed on for a secret or top secret or special access clearance. The oath we take is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. But what do we do when a program we are read into violates the Constitution? When our agency blatantly shows contempt for the civil protections guaranteed therein? As the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, the answer doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. At this point, our oath mandates that we defend the Constitution from the intelligence agency we work for that has now become a domestic enemy. We are duty-bound to fight for our citizens' constitutional rights that have been violated. As a servant of the people, this is our solemn promise, our sworn oath. Thanks, Russ. That clarified it. And it only deepens the respect I have for you. And Joe Clarici, a listener, subscriber to the Peter B. Collins podcast, made this post on Facebook, and I wanted to share it with you. He says this was pointed out by some unnamed insightful pundit who wrote, "We're talking about the candidate's health, but not health care. We're talking about Hillary Clinton's and Colin Powell's hacked emails, but not the NSA spying on all of ours. We're talking about the candidate's individual tax returns and not the U.S. tax system. Small minds discuss people. Great minds discuss ideas." Well, Gary Chu is the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins podcast, and he filed this review of Oliver Stone's new feature film, Snowden.
The elephant in the screening room that sat in the back row wasn't symbolic of the Republican Party as much as it was George Orwell. The metaphor just sat there, quietly watching Oliver Stone's latest film called Snowden with everyone else. While all of us weighed whether national security is more important than privacy, or to put it another way, is personal privacy more important than the safety and future of our country? The dilemma deepened as the story of Edward Snowden's blowing of a loud and shrill whistle on the National Security Agency for its overreaching and covert surveillance of Americans and most other earthly things has technologically proliferated at full throttle. The film is immaculately constructed and communicates with amazing clarity. It's set in the Hong Kong hotel where Snowden has fled from the United States, the venue in which he unloads his data to the care of Glenn Greenwald of the Guardian newspaper and Laura Poitras, who made Citizen Four, the Academy Award-winning documentary of Snowden. Snowden is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Greenwald by Zachary Quinto, and Poitras by Melissa Leo. Stone repeatedly jumps ahead in time, then back to the hotel room and again forward to spin the film. The celebrated and controversial film director makes it plain with unobtrusive but helpful graphics so you know exactly where in time and place he's taking you. I wish more people who make complex movies that fast forward and go back in time would craft their work as clearly as Stone does with this piece of cinema. Having not delved into Snowden's backstory, the picture told me he has a history of epilepsy. I mention this only because the visuals Stone puts to these fleeting scenes are almost as remarkable as his use of a film montage. Look for them. You might be slightly amazed, especially with a montage that ends with a close-up of a human eye. Gordon-Levitt has been impressive in his previous films. He steps solidly forward in his young acting career to really nail being Snowden. It becomes especially obvious following the feature when, through the miracle of satellite communications, I got to see moments when Snowden himself, in Moscow, would speak with Gordon-Levitt, who was situated in New York City. This was a special event that made it possible for me to see Snowden, then watch on the same screen a conversation that included Snowden, Gordon-Levitt, Shailene Woodley, she plays Snowden's girlfriend Lindsay, Stone, and a moderator. This is an important movie to see, whether you think Snowden is a hero or a traitor. It's about how a government should balance its duty to keep a nation secure and protect the privacy of the people who live in it. Too bad the crowd was sparse. I have to confess I was surprised. Snowden is a hot topic, wherever you come down on it. Yet Snowden has all the tension, suspense, and even action that the ho-hum routine movies usually have for selling tickets, soda, and popcorn. Shortly before the film began, a gentleman with a beard was just arriving. On seeing the few of us seated in the auditorium, he shouted out something to the effect, "Ah, we're the ones who really care." It was due to our diminutive number that we all seemed to bond. Snowden opens wide for all Friday, September 16th. Be there. Maybe Obama will see it. For the Peter B. Collins Podcasts, I'm Gary Chu in Sacramento.
Thanks for the review, Gary Chu, and thanks to all of you for listening to this podcast, now available on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy Happy Trails.